to fit their narrative. And this really caused a huge outcry at a certain point in 2005. Polls were taken and a majority of Americans actually supported impeachment. There was pressure put on Nancy Pelosi to take action, but she pushed back against that idea. So Cynthia lost her elections, a long story. She lost her re-election bid in 2006. And she couldn't sort of hold herself back. She had wanted to introduce articles of impeachment throughout much of her term. So I'll explain in a moment why there was pressure on her not to do it. And finally, they were introduced on the very last day of her term in December of 2006. So if your boss asked you to draft articles of impeachment, where would you start? A question for the audience, a rhetorical question, I guess. But so John and I, first of all, sat down for several weeks and read thoroughly on the subject. We caught up on all the current reading and literature and what many others had drafted or written about what was going on at that time. But John kept coming back to one central point before we really started drafting what we wrote. And that takes us back to the framers. So we go back to Virginia, July 20th, 1787, in the famous debate involving most notoriously George Mason and James Madison. So just a couple of quotes from that debate. First of all, George Mason asks, "Shall any man be above justice? Shall that man be above?" Pictures. "Shall that man be above it who can commit the most extensive injustice?" And John kept reiterating this point that the thing about impeachment is that a person in a position of a tremendous power and authority is in a unique position to abuse that power and authority. They can commit so-called crimes or misdemeanors or malfeasance that few others can commit. So that makes impeachment different from other proceedings, essentially. And that kind of allowed us to move forward. Secondly, Edmund Randolph writes, "The executive will have great opportunities of abusing his power, particularly at a time of war when the military force and in some respects, the public money will be in his hands," which seemed to speak to what was going on in the 2000s. James Madison, in response to the proposition that the language used the term maladministration, said that's too vague of a term. It's equivalent to, you know, saying that the president serves up the tenure of the president. It gives too much power to the Senate. It's too vague. You could pin anything, anybody for anything on that. And George Mason then offered substitute. That's where we get this phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors. Notably, the original phrase was against the state. It was then edited to say against the United States. And this comes back to the point that John was reiterating. And so here's a quote from the Smithsonian Institute commenting on this. Again, I need to move you guys so I can read this. The Smithsonian writes, "Unfortunately for everyone who's argued about what an impeachable offense is since then, the Convention's Committee on Style and Revision, which was supposed to improve the draft, without changing its meaning, deleted the phrase against the United States. Without that phrase, which explained what constitutes high crimes, many Americans have come to believe that high crimes literally meant only crimes identified in criminal law." And I think this is a really common misperception about impeachment. It is not a criminal proceeding. The word crime in this context does not mean against any specific law. It again comes back to, you know, abuse of office, the use of, you know, extraordinarily powerful position to commit acts against the state that few others are in a position to do. So we ended up framing the document that we presented to Cynthia under three articles. The first one was a failure to ensure that the laws are faithfully executed, abuse of office and executive privilege was the second article, and failure to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And in all, we had 17 points. The first article had 7. And in this article, we cited legislation that we felt the administration was in violation of. So illegal domestic spying in violation of the FISA Act, self-exemption of laws upon signing, noting 800 challenges to legislation upon signing of laws, suspension of basic legal proceedings violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice, promoting illegal war, violating Article 1 of the UN Charter, which explicitly forbids aggressive warfare, as well as the 6th Article of the Constitution, promoting illegal torture, violation of the Army Field Manual, as well as federal torture statutes, promoting kidnappings and renditions for illegal torture, violating the UN Convention Against Torture, and use of illegal weapons, violating the Geneva Protocols. In the second article, this wasn't so much about violating laws as, you know, abusing office. So obstructing inquiry and detection. We quoted George Mason again when he talked about the president pardoning crimes which were advised by himself and then, you know, not cooperating with Congress in terms of investigations. Second, replacing the veto with signing statements, hundreds of laws passed by Congress being challenged again by the administration, rather than simply using the veto, just sort of, you know, making caveats, I'll follow this law, I won't follow that law, and so forth. Third, failure to uphold accountability. And here we named four administrative officials, Dick Cheney for manipulating intelligence, Alberto Gonzalez for granting limitless authority to the presidency, Condoleezza Rice for false statements to promote war, and Donald Rumsfeld for promoting torture. Article three, failure to protect, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution was, first of all, manipulating intelligence and lying to justify war in violation of a constitutional separation of powers, initiating war without a declaration in violation of the War Powers Act, which says only Congress can declare war. This is not a new thing. Most presidents since the end of the Second World War have, you know, used euphemisms like, you know, in the Korean War, it was a, what was it called, a combat action and so forth, different terminology to sort of not use this term war when we now refer to the Korean War, the Vietnam War, et cetera. Suspension of due process in violation of the Fifth Amendment, specifically suspending habeas corpus, which, you know, goes, takes us back to the 13th century and the Magna Carta, a bedrock of, you know, modern law. Unreasonable searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment, corrupting the FISA courts, violating the Constitution's separation of powers, non-cooperation with Congress, Article 1 of the Constitution, establishment of a separate parallel legal system. So that's a lot of stuff for you to take in. So I only want to focus here on three of these articles. First of all, 5 and 6 of Article 1, promoting torture and renditions for torture. And in looking at this, you know, we went to the Geneva Conventions. What did the Geneva Convention say? Part 1, Article 2 of the Geneva Convention says, prisoners of war shall at all times be humanely treated and protected, particularly against acts of violence from insults and from public curiosity. Measures of reprisal against them are forbidden. So, you know, to me, this reads, you cannot even sort of strike someone on the cheek. You cannot physically, you know, do anything to a prisoner of war. Now, granted, this isn't a time when, first of all, there were agreements of laws of war, and, you know, there was this notion of gentlemanly warfare, but most specifically, and as Joe Biden pointed out during this time period, you know, the concern was what the other side would do to our guys. So there was, you know, an agreement that if, you know, if you guys treat your guys well, we'll treat yours well. Part 3, Section 2, Article 9, prisoners of war may be interned in fenced camps. They shall not be confined or imprisoned except as a measure of indispensable for safety or health, and only so long as circumstances exist which necessitate such a measure. So again, humane treatment, nothing here that would permit, you know, indefinite detention in prison sentences. Well, as you're probably familiar with, White House counsel and later Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez commented on this, as did numerous lawyers for the administration. He was quoted widely as saying the Geneva Conventions were quaint. He meant specifically certain sections of the Geneva Conventions were quaint. But his broad statement was, you know, in my judgment, the war on terrorism renders obsolete the Geneva Convention's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners. And this, of course, was when he was being questioned about waterboarding. Then I want to draw your attention to Article 7 of Article 3, point 7 of Article 3, establishment of a unconstitutional parallel legal system. And here we go to the Constitution. where all legislative powers, Article 1, Section 1, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. So what happened? The public was not told what was going on, and then suddenly it was revealed that there was this system where we're using a new term made out of whole cloth called enemy combatants, where prisons and black sites are being set up to detain captured combatants, presumed combatants, indefinitely without trial, without access to law, without following habeas corpus. And this was set up by the executive branch. Congress was not informed. So what did the Congress then do? Under a Republican majority Congress, they passed the Military Commissions Act in 2006 and essentially then made this into law. But during that period before it was made into law, the executive branch had essentially created an entirely new legislative system without the power to do so under the Constitution. Notably also Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution specifically mentions the writ of corpus, habeas corpus, says it cannot be suspended. Now it's talking about powers of Congress here, but it's, I think that's significant to know. And the Eighth Amendment, which bans cruel and unusual punishment, is also important in this context. So out of this, in the aftermath of these legal documents arguing that we're no longer bound by the Geneva Conventions and a host of other legislation, of course, we get the Abu Ghraib scandal. We get CIA's rendition programs, sending captives to dozens of countries around the world where they were held in black sites, often tortured. We get Guantanamo. And out of Guantanamo, 2021, we're getting a new film called The Mauritanian, starring Cumberbatch and Jodie Foster, painting a pretty grim picture of all of this. The Center for Victims of Torture has, given us this chart showing us that, of the original nearly 800, 900 detainees, 532 were released or transferred, 197 were transferred under Obama, none under the Trump administration, but only so far three as of 2018 had been convicted. 10 more were currently being in trial. So those are enormously skewed numbers. What happened here, if you're familiar with the story, and the Center for Constitutional Rights did a lot of good work on this, what was happening, particularly in Afghanistan, during the days after the US invasion, was that informants were being paid to name people. So people were being named, they would tell the US authorities, and then they would be picked up and they could find themselves in Guantanamo, having done nothing, because many of these people were named simply because somebody saw the opportunity to get some money. And this was a dreadful miscarriage of justice. So again, our 17 points, I wanna point out that of these in green here, in the aqua, are those which would relate to foreign policy. In the green, under Article 1 and 2, I have those that survived the draft, and number 1 of Article 3 survived the draft, and it's the only one of the three which may pertain to foreign policy. So what happened? We presented the draft to Cynthia, and I was supposed to meet with her on July 9th, 2006. It was the day that the Congressional Black Caucus had just ended. We had just finished a bunch of conferences, we were exhausted, but I was told to go wait in the congressional office and she would come and I would walk her through our draft. She never showed up. Why did she never show up? I didn't get an explanation right away. I'll fill you in a moment what I think happened. But later we had a meeting outside the office, and I was a media guy, and he put her on camera and started asking her questions about the draft, which she essentially hadn't really read yet. And she was having trouble answering those questions. So he gets out his pen. I'm not going to name names, but he gets out his pen and he crosses out what he feels would be unacceptable. This is somebody with no background in any of this. When we were then showed what he had done, we were, our faces were red, John and I. I was left with the difficult job of figuring out how to mold this all down to just the three remaining points This is what became H Resolution 1106 in the 109th Congress that was dropped on the last day of Cynthia's term in office. There was a press conference. I don't know of any news agency that actually ran a story from that. I don't have time to kind of go into why that is, but John and I, you know, throughout writing this, were never intending for this. We did not see any hope or prospect of the Democratic Party as a whole, so picking this up and running with it. Nancy Pelosi had made it clear that she was not interested in moving forward with impeachment against the Bush administration. So we saw it as, you know, getting stuff into the record for posterity. So what happened then in 2006 and 2008 is John and I attended a meeting where Dennis Kucinich was announcing his bid for the presidency in 2008. Meanwhile, Cynthia decided she had had enough of the Democratic Party and went to the Green Party and ended up getting nominated for the Green Party presidential ticket. And Kucinich commented to me once that she kind of picked the wrong year to run. But at any rate, both of these individuals were running. Well, because at this meeting with Kucinich, somebody told him about John and I working on impeachment articles. So he called us into his office and asked us if we'd work with him. We ended up contributing to drafts that were finalized by his staff. There was another individual, David Swanson, who was doing a lot of work on this too, and I believe he contributed to the background to these drafts. So the first of these articles was specifically aimed at Dick Cheney. I'll just read the three articles: the fabricating evidence regarding the threat posed by Iraq to justify an invasion, deceiving Congress and public regarding Al-Qaeda and Iraq's relationship, Article 3, threatening aggression against Iran. He introduced these articles twice, so they were twice named in April and November of 2007. And all of these are relating to foreign policy. So we continued the work, and the next draft included 35 articles of impeachment against Bush. Again, I didn't have any hand in the final drafting of this one. And you will see a lot of that original, those original 17 points reappearing here. And in fact, at one point, Kucinich was suggesting that we go take it out to 100 articles. So I started, you know, crunching away on that. I was up to like 60 some ideas before. And this is showing you which ones were relating to foreign policy before 2008 stock market crash. And what happened at that point was that, you know, Kucinich was getting calls from his district back in Ohio. Things were falling apart. People couldn't pay their mortgages and so forth. And he needed, his staff was saying, nobody cares about impeachment anymore. They just want you to go back and try to sort things out in Ohio. So he essentially, you know, decided we're done. And I was doing all of this, by the way, in an unpaid capacity, volunteer all throughout. Because I had been laid off from my legislative job before we actually started the drafting of the articles. So I at that point turned back to finishing my dissertation is what I did. So that's, you know, my personal story. There's a lot of side stories. One of the funny stories is that at one of these meetings with Kucinich, John thought, well, we were both at that point looking for jobs in Congress. And John thought, well, what if we could work out of Dennis's office? And he's like, well, we don't have any openings. And he's like, well, what about interning? And so we actually showed up one morning at 9 a.m. and this 21-year-old kid, I'm, you know, in my late 40s and John's in his late 50s, early 60s, comes out, redheaded kid with freckles, and says, okay, so you show up at 9 and you leave at 5. And we're like, every day? And he's like, yep. We're like, 40 hours a week? Uh-huh. And so there's John and I answering the phones in Kucinich's office for I don't remember how many days, but when I got a tongue lashing from one of Kucinich's staff who was worried about what influence impeachment would have on his reelection chances, I just decided I couldn't do this anymore. So I resigned my unpaid internship in Kucinich's office. But John hung on there for a while, hoping, you know, he could maybe find some more work. So that's a kind of, you know, amusing side story. All right, so let's turn to part two, an empire. What is this all about? So here I've got some stuff. I'm going to read some of what I've written here. Start by sort of arguing that the United States was always was born out of empire. So this image is of 1513, when the Spanish conquistador Ponce de Leon made the first European landing in Florida. He arrived with an army of hundreds of armored soldiers, expecting to fight a conventional army, only to be wiped out 8 years later by disease and the poison-tipped arrows of the indigenous Calusa people. It's also a kind of tragic comic story. So taking that through 1805, when Lewis and Clark at last, after all of these centuries of searching, find the Columbia River that takes them out to the Pacific Ocean, the passage to India, which was the original enterprise of, you know, crossing the Americas. To the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 1848. Of course, I'm going to talk about 1898, the Spanish-American War. But kind of towards the tail end, the annexation of Alaska in 1958, Hawaii in 1959. The whole story of American history has been what DeVoto in his book titles his book, you know, The Course of Empire. So empire is not a new theme in American history. So although the Monroe Doctrine and its call for an open door policy in China had made it the United States a player, it didn't become sort of an official member of the Club of Colonial Empires until 1898, when it took control of Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Guam from Spain in the Spanish-American War. It took control of Hawaii in the same year. and of course, in the early 1900s, the Panama Canal. So suddenly the United States has this, you know, vast territory spanning tens of thousands of miles and becomes a major player in the game of imperialism. Writing in the 1950s at Wisconsin, the historians William Appleton Williams and Henry Harvey Harrington argued that out of the great debate of 1898 to 1901 about further American expansion, a consensus was reached that American might would, quote, dominate all underdeveloped areas of the world in a, quote, classic strategy of non-colonial imperial expansion by relentlessly expanding its informal empire. An informal empire, however, was not above military aggression, they argued. They and their students argued, and this was during the Cold War, and this garnered a response, an attack on the Wisconsin school from such luminaries as Arthur and Schlesinger Jr., you know, saying this is sort of an unpatriotic position to take. Well, once the Cold War ended, it became impossible to avoid confronting the undeniable reality, as McCoy writes, of a global behemoth that transcended past experiences. The debate turned once more to what kind of an empire is this? Was the United States an imperium like Rome, a dominium enforced by a single power, as the term sole superpower would suggest, or was it a hegemon, applying a mixture of force and force combined with cooperation, garnering consent along the lines of ancient Athens and its Delian League? In his recent 2017 book, Alfred McCoy writes, in short, analysts across the political spectrum had come to agree that empire was the most appropriate word to describe America's current superpower status. And yet, McCoy continues, compared to the countless books and articles that crowded library shelves covering every imaginable aspect of European colonial rule, there is still surprisingly little serious study of history's most powerful empire. He goes on and says, empires are the most elusive, complex, and paradoxical of all forms of governance, strong yet often surprisingly fragile. At their peaks, empires can crush rival powers or curb subordinate states, yet their power is surprisingly vulnerable to erosion or to simply slipping away. Unlike conventional states, empires face exceptional costs in mounting risky military operations and maintaining costly overseas presence. And that last phrase should ring, you know, familiar to all of us when we think about US involvement around the world with, you know, something like 800 plus military bases in over 120 countries. So the debate then, we're gonna go back a little bit, that's a 2017 quote, but going back to, you know, the early 2000s saw a lot of publications wrestling with this question of what is the nature of the American empire? And here are two. In their 2000 book, Hart and Negri argue that in the age of globalization, it's the sovereignty of the nation state that's in steady decline. As they put it, as money, technology, people, and goods move with increasing ease across national boundaries, thus escaping attempts by nation states to regulate such flows. The sovereignty of individual nations, they argue, is now being replaced by a new form of sovereignty they call empire, composed, as they write, of a series of national and supranational organisms under a united, united under a single logic of rule. Well, my supervisor, the late Ellen Mikeson-Swood, who we lost in 2015, responded to this in a 2003 book called Empire of Capital. She's arguing the opposite. She's saying that imperial hegemony relies now more than ever on an orderly system of many local states. And global economic hegemony depends upon keeping control of the many states that maintain the economy. The US invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq then did not so much establish a new rule of empire as they were aberrations from the normal operations of American empire, since American preeminence had been established at the end of World War II. And these, she writes, were one, overwhelming military superiority to preempt any would-be challengers and to ensure global or regional hegemony, what the Pentagon refers to in its documents as full spectrum dominance. And secondly, regular displays of military force, like for example, shock and awe, to assert dominance in ways often lacking specific objectives. She calls this the demonstration effect. So for Wood, the United States has built the world's first truly capitalist empire, which she distinguishes from all previous empires. And his book is really more a review of all these previous empires than the American empire. But she distinguishes them from the American empire in the first place because these, even the British empire, were built on the acquisition of territory in non-capitalist societies where the majority of the population were not consumers and laborers, but peasant farmers who still produced for their own subsistence. Thus, much the way that European feudal lords dealt with serfs and peasants, colonial administrators, on the one hand, levied taxes on peasants, usually through local middlemen like the zamindars in India, who were allowed to keep a portion of the taxes for themselves. And on the other hand, applied various forms of direct coercion or extra economic power to secure supplies of forced labor, to secure compliance, and to secure and to suppress rebellion. Today, however, geopolitical rivalry between colonial empires has been replaced, she argues, by capitalist competition in the global marketplace. Today, more than one of two humans lives in cities, and by 2050, that figure will be 3 out of 4. And that's gonna be the subject, hopefully, of my next talk. I'm gonna talk about, you know, the turn to super cities, and we'll get more into that maybe later. You know, she's arguing that this is a different kind of empire, and this the fundamental logic of it is not the old school of empire. It's more about, you know, so this is, for example, why we see sanctions, the use of sanctions against so many countries. It's the use of, you know, regulating trade. It's domination, not just through military might. Some of you may be familiar with another book from this time period, Sheldon Wolin, his book, Democracy, Inc. And he introduces us to two concepts which kind of fit well with Wood's presentation. One is what he calls managed democracy. He says that issue is more than crude bribery. Campaign contributions are vital, but are an essential element of a managed democracy. There's no physical violence here. He ends by saying the wild tactics are not those of the Nazis. The end result is the inverted equivalent. And this is where he talks about inverted totalitarianism. An inversion produces actions ordinarily associated with its antithesis. For example, when the elected executive may imprison an accused without due process and sanction the use of torture while instructing the nation about the sanctity of law. It's a system that professes to be the opposite of what in fact it is. It disclaims its real identity, trusting that its deviations will become normalized as change. Again, exactly the opposite of classic totalitarians who, far from disguising their break with the constitutional system of the past, celebrated it. So what's the link between what he's saying and empire? He writes, management is not a neutral notion, however. Its roots are in the business culture. Its values shaped by the pressures of a competitive economy that persistently pushed the limits of legality and ethical norms. The arrogance that leads corporate executives to violate the law finds its parallel in the arrogance with which superpowers flout or disregard international law. So in the same time period, Niall Ferguson basically was making the argument that America is a reluctant empire. He says it's an empire that lacks the drive to export its capital, its people, culture, you know, like the old empires. It's an empire, in short, that dare not speak its name. It's an empire in denial. And he says, as the German theologian Reinhold Niebuhr noted in 1960, Americans persist in frantically avoiding recognition of the imperialism they de facto exercise. Does this matter? Yes. And then he basically goes on to argue that we need to, you know, step up to our responsibilities as Americans in our empire. And so this is kind of the key argument I want to take issue with, that we should embrace our destiny as a country with an empire. And that's where my first thesis comes in, because as I've argued, empire involves increasing move away from accountability. The construction of imperial presidency means a presidency that's less accountable. So a citizenry which embraces empire must relax that accountability, and that means diminishing democracy and then undermining the presumed mission of the United States of promoting democracy. Another argument against that position is that empires are violent. Empires are involved in massacres. And so the most notable massacres that come to mind, the use of force to suppress dissent would be the Amritsar massacre, where unarmed protesters in India were mowed down by British forces in 1919. In case of the United States, you may think immediately of My Lai in 1968, El Mozote in El Salvador in 1981, and more recently, the Nisour Square massacre in 2007. For which those who convicted were recently pardoned by the president. Another aspect of the United States has been subverting elections, and I was trying to grab one quote from McCoy where he had some data on, comparing the United States and the Soviet Union in terms of how many elections were overturned during the Cold War. But the most notable, coups, regime change actions are 1953 in Iran, 54 in Guatemala, 65 in the Dominican Republic, 73 in Chile, the Contra War in the 80s, most recently under Obama, the coup in Honduras in 2009. And this is a map just, showing the number of military interventions in Latin America. It conjures up that phrase from Jefferson, who was anticipating the Monroe Doctrine and saying, the United States will have a hemisphere unto itself. So I want to briefly walk through the last three presidents before Biden. We've talked already about Bush, so I'm not going to go over these. Obama's failures, in my view, were, first of all, his promise to close Guantanamo, leaving it open. Failure to prosecute Wall Street crimes. Not a single Wall Street executive was brought to criminal charges for the meltdown of 2007-08 and all of the obviously illegal actions that happened there. And we don't have time to talk about it, but escalating drone warfare is a topic I sometimes talk about in one of my classes. Trump, I sort of stole this from a book which is now a bit dated by Bruce Fine et al. Accepting foreign and domestic emoluments, violating the emoluments clause. He did not divest himself of his business before taking office, concealing foreign assistance to campaigns, abusing the pardon power, advocating illegal violence and undermining equality, and threatening nuclear war, reckless endangerment. Those are some of many others, potential articles of impeachment which have been put forward against Trump. And of course, we know about the two impeachments that have already happened. It conjures up James Madison's quote that some provision should be made for defending the community against the incapacity, negligence, or perfidy of the chief magistrate. He might pervert his administration into a scheme of peculation, embezzlement, or oppression. He might betray his trust to foreign powers. So this also brings up my second thesis, which is an empire which uses force to subvert elections abroad is not immune to the application of force to subvert elections at home. If the United States can go into Guatemala in 1954 and overturn an election and so on, that's a precedent that could actually come back to be used at home. It also brings up another founder's quote, William Davey. Impeachment, he wrote, is an essential security for the good behavior of the president. Otherwise, he will spare no efforts or means whatever to get himself reelected. Which to me is an ominous quote, given that, yes, Trump was impeached in relation to what happened on January 6th, but he was not removed from office. His supporters have said they're not finished. They plan to continue. And so third thesis, impeachment could be used to hold presidents accountable for violations of human rights under national law. but to date it has not been used to such. And moreover, in an imperial empire, in an empire with an imperial presidency, this is highly unlikely. Chalmers Johnson, who's written many books on American empire, wrote that the demise of the American empire will be no more regretted than the demise of the Soviet empire. In other words, people in general do not like empires. The American empire will not be remembered well as such. I know I'm almost out of time, but I briefly want to bring in China. There's a lot of talk about China as a rising rival to the United States. And here I want to quote the honors paper that Shanae wrote with me. And she wrote it about China's use of sharp power. And she gives us the definition here of authoritarian regimes perforate the political and information spheres of other nations in order to deceive and manipulate public and governmental perceptions and agendas to ultimately be favorable to their policies. She's talking about, for example, China's aggressive manipulation of journalists' accounts of China, trying to shape impressions about China in countries like Australia. This is the poster that she created for our poster ceremony. And I just want to draw your attention to two things. One is this diagram here, the move from soft power to the recently coined term sharp power to hard power. So China, she's putting China sort of somewhere in the middle here. In other words, China's not invading countries. It's not, going on in any large scale military aggression, and military aggression is not really a part of China's history. But it is being very aggressive in these ways, and that's significant. So Sinead wrote, perhaps sharp power is the way of the future. In a world in which narratives are tailored and demented by governments is the reality we must all expect. Perhaps transparency will no longer be a desired quality of nations, and rather the manipulation of the truth, which reasserts a nation's dominance in the world, is the likely eventuality. Perhaps in order to outsmart China, playing by the rules of the game is the only possibility. Perhaps it is, as Orwell wrote in 1984, who controls the past controls the future, who controls the present controls the past. By that logic, whoever controls the narrative of the present controls the future. So two things. One is this speaks to, where China's at today. It's not in a position, it has regional pretenses of having regional hegemony, but not global hegemony. But lacking that pretense to global hegemony, it is resorting to the use of sharp power. And this is disturbing. But it also echoes, in my mind, the kind of lying that we have been subject to here in the United States. So to quickly conclude, the two final theses that we have an impeachment system that is extremely partisan, and that has to do with the two-party system. A democracy will not function if any near majority party only participates to the extent that elections are decided in its favor. So not much you can do if you've got a major party or near majority party that really doesn't want to play by the rules of the game. Lack of accountability on the Trump administration follows decades of establishing the imperial presidency. Authoritarian around the world is on the rise. Xenophobia is on the rise in Europe and North America. And I wanted to make sure I mentioned the Black Lives Matter movement and how that did not stay domestic. It has gone global, and we saw this. This is folks trying to take down the statue of Cecil Rhodes, the great colonizer. To me, this is very heartening in the sense that it shows that people remember their history, but it also shows that many people around the world are saying no to that racial legacy of colonialism, which is really quite something in 2021. The turn to the Beijing consensus in the developing world. So many developing countries are now looking to China as a model. They understand it has an authoritarian political system, but they're interested in the growth model, how China is achieving high growth rates. And lastly, going back to the early 20th century debates on imperialism, the British economist J.H. Hobson talked about how empire actually doesn't benefit the population, it only benefits the investors. And I think that's generally correct, and it's a problem. But one of the things that all of these early critics, including Lenin, generally missed was the cultural dimension. What William Appleman Williams talked about in his book, Empire as a Way of Life, there is a cultural dimension to empire that you have to wrestle with too. So I'm gonna stop there because we're a little over time, but thank you for listening, and I'll take some questions.
Great. Thanks very much, Mike. We will move on to the Q&A portion in just a moment. You can submit your questions via the chat function. The chat box icon should be located near your audio and video buttons. And while we're waiting for questions to come in, I would like to mention that we have excellent programs lined up for the remainder of the spring semester, including a presentation next week by Luis Martinez de Dio on artistic responses to the European Union and its integration project. We will send out our usual program announcements each Thursday, but please also feel free to check our website for the latest updates on future online programs. That's at www.icfrc.org. Let me also say that we're grateful to be able to make our online programs free and open to the public, but we rely on the support of our members and attendees in order to operate. We would deeply appreciate a free will donation to help us cover our operating expenses, particularly during this time of online-only programming. You can find the link to donate in the chat section. And with that, we can now begin the Q&A. And I do not see a question now. Maybe I'll throw one out to get us started, which is just if you could talk a little bit about how what would be a non-imperial way for a country like the U.S. to operate in world affairs and to play a positive role? Kind of what if the governmental policies of the U.S. could be made less imperialistic, what would that look like?
It's a really hard question, because I think a lot of the justification for these types of policies, including that of Niall Ferguson, is that, you know, we've got the best system going. We've got democracy. We have rights. And if we let go of our grip on the world, you know, you're going to get terrorism. You're going to get authoritarianism, et cetera, et cetera. So that, you know, argument would keep you very locked into that. The first thing that comes to mind is Chalmers Johnson's book, The Sorrows of Empire, which I highly recommend. And he basically presents two solutions to this dilemma, because he sees US decline as inevitable. And he says there's sort of two exit strategies. One is we can do what Rome did and try to hang on at dear cost, the Western Roman Empire, and pay the price with, you know, dreadful, long, painful decline. Or we can do what the British Empire did, which is decide to get out of the game of empire and survive and make a fair, reasonably basic transition out of empire. I don't have a lot of ideas about that, because I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, how do you do this? That's his ideas, but he doesn't really tell us how to do it. One of the things that, you know, concerns me is I've been doing some work on the Spanish Empire, and that's another different model, because the Spanish Empire really ruined itself financially by overspending on military affairs particularly. And so one can see a parallel potentially between the decline of the Spanish Empire and the American Empire, and the way in which there's some evidence that during this pandemic, you know, 354 billionaires have now increased their wealth by 1.5 trillion. There's a lot of graft and corruption going on in terms of increasing the wealth of the people at the top. And there's some concerns of where that's taking us. So those are my responses, but in terms of how we get there, I mean, I can only suggest that we try to be true to virtuous principles, you know, supporting democracy, supporting human rights, taking those concepts seriously, and supporting accountability, holding public officials accountable when they violate laws and norms and procedures. It's not a great answer, but that's about all I've got.
Other questions? Here we've got one. Are there strategies that other countries or international institutions such as the UN, the EU, or others might use that could counteract or shift America away from empire?
I think one of the things that's going on right now is, you know, there's a kind of breaking down of relationships. Russia is saying we no longer have a relationship with the EU. The EU has been trying to figure a way of kind of getting out of the US's sphere of control directly. I mean, you may recall that the euro the idea was that it was going to kind of break the EU off of dependence on the US dollar. It didn't achieve that. So countries have been trying, and of course China, you might say, has been maybe the most successful in terms of carving out its own sphere of influence and sort of putting itself on a trajectory for ever increasing influence which is why I think you have all of the nervousness around China. But none of those ways, I mean, to take the European Union, it was, you know, one commentator said it was set up of and by and for the banks. In a way, the European Union, the way it was set up, was a move away from democracy, not toward democracy. And I think that's very concerning. And I think it also is one of the reasons why the EU is having a lot of problems. So do I have some ready-made models? No, I would just go back to, you know, articulating virtuous principles.
We've got another question asking you to predict the future. what does the future hold with the growing global assertiveness of China and the waning influence of the US?
You know, my professor, George Commonell, told me never write about the future because you're always going to be wrong. Definitely China's on a growth trajectory. I've spent about a year of my life in China, and the transformation that's going on in China is really staggering, particularly in its cities. I think if you go to the hinterland, you aren't going to be as impressed. You're still going to see a lot of problems and poverty. But I don't see China currently as in a position to directly challenge US power and hegemony. I can't really predict how long that might take. I still think we're in a U.S. global order, for a good long time to come. The pandemic may actually speed up that decline. It's not clear, but this is it's going to be a long, slow process. And so, I mean, it's also a really opportune time then, therefore, as Americans, to start having this conversation about how we want to manage that process.
All right. Those are good answers to the future. Any questions? Here's one about the past. Given the US's experience in trying to impeach various presidents, do you think this is still a useful mechanism to hold our presidents accountable?
Well, as I argued, I think it has always been an entirely partisan affair. And in a two-party system, it's one party's gain at the expense of the other party, clearly, as we've seen. I mean, we did have 7 Republicans cross over, and that is the most we've had in any impeachment, in the most recent impeachment. But the outcome was gravitated back to norms. I mean, it's been argued that impeachment serves another purpose, and that is just sort of serving notice and putting the public on notice. And that's really the motivation that John and I and Kucinich and so forth had in terms of, getting this stuff on record, kind of put folks on notice. I remember reading that 2 weeks after we introduced those articles, the Bush administration announced that it was going to start following the rules of the FISA court again. I don't know if that was due to us, but I would like to think that was a minor impact there. So in that sense, I think impeachment does have an effect. But I think, I would support a system where it's a more of a rudimentary thing. If somebody is violating their office, you either temporarily or permanently suspend them and find somebody else who can do that job. But I think the problem with impeachment is that we have really quite contrary to the ideas of the founders, put so much power and authority in the hands of the executive branch. That it's all or nothing problem. It's that, that is now the locus of power and everybody's trying to get their hands on the throne. And that's what makes impeachment such a big deal with so much at stake,
Okay, we'll follow up with another question about impeachment. Can you offer any lessons about impeachment at the presidential level that apply to other officials, judges, state leaders, et cetera?
Well, I've wanted to sit down and kind of read up on a lot of other impeachments that have happened, and I haven't, but my impression is that impeachment's been much more successful in terms of functioning at the lower levels. And I would say that's, again, to reiterate my last point, because there's less at stake. It's more of a one person's office at stake rather than, the entire budget and resources of the government. At that level, it has been, I think, quite an effective mechanism. And I would agree with, in that sense, John Nichols' title, the genius of impeachment. It is a great tool if it can be made to work.
Great. To go back to a question I skipped earlier, if the Bush-Cheney regime fabricated the data that led to the Iraq War, why have they suffered no consequences and why did they do it?
Why did they do it is one of those, you'd really have to do some research and you'd have to get, really get their interviews and so forth. And of course, if they're not admitting that they fabricated the evidence, they're not going to tell you. But, one commentator argued that the Iraq War was the first truly capitalist war because you had so many private interests lining up for contracts from the get-go, looking at Iraq as a kind of bonanza for profit-making from the war itself, from the reconstruction, from the oil reconstruction, and so forth. I think there was a lot of push from the private sector for this war, but there were a lot of factors. And, you know, going back to Ellen's point, it was also about just simply demonstrating U.S. power in the aftermath of the Cold War, first in Panama and then in Iraq. You know, I'm somewhat mystified that they actually went through with it. I was very much part of the campaign to try to, you know, stop that invasion in 2003. We always kind of felt it was coming. On the day of 9/11, I was in New York City, and my colleague Kathy Kelly, her first comment after seeing the towers go down was, "There'll be nothing left of Iraq," because she had led many delegations of humanitarian efforts to Iraq and was, you know, deeply concerned that this would lead to an invasion, which it did. It's a very long conversation to talk
about. Right. We've come to the end of our time. Several other good questions in the chat function, and so it's a shame that we can't get to them. But I want to thank you, Mike, for giving us this talk today, and a very wonderful presentation and sharing your expertise. I get to virtually present you with the coveted Iowa City Foreign Relations Council coffee mug for coffee, tea, or the beverage of your choice. We will coordinate delivery details with you soon.
Let's meet at a coffee shop.
Well, won't that be great? Yeah, we're going to get back to doing that. Let me thank our sponsors again for their generous support. Thanks also to all our viewers today and everyone who joined us. We are adjourned.
Thank you.